to the Queensbound F local train. The next stop is...
This is the Culinary Historians of New York.
I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Sunny Alera Graham is a recent graduate of Bard Graduate Center for Decorative Arts, Design, History, and Material Culture, where she focused on cookbooks and early modern culinary history. She is currently employed by the Museum of Jewish Heritage while also working on an independent research project about the eating preferences of the literary figure Goethe. Without further ado, I'm going to ask you to either hold or clip. Thank you.
Have you click them? All right. Good evening, guys. Thank you for having me. I'm a new member, and I'm really excited to be here. So without further ado, this brief presentation you will hear today stems from a portion of my master's thesis in which I attempted to recreate the biography of an anonymous receipt book from the New York Academy of Medicine by investigating the sources of the recipes. The title of my thesis and this talk was taken from the title page of this book, which reads, A Collection of Choice Receipts. You can slide. Grouped together seemingly at random, the book contains 390 recipes of various kinds. In this book, medical recipes for the plague share pages with recipes for the best great cake. In many cases, sources are attributed to the recipes. Like the recipes themselves, the sources consulted are varied. They include family members, potential neighbors, and in a few instances, even the queen is named. Recipes are a particularly rich source of cultural exchange, a point made literal when one examines the root of the word, which comes from the Latin recipere, meaning exchange. Domestic recipe collections in early modern England provide a fascinating case study of sharing recipes through manuscript collections, often referred to as receipt books. So receipt is just interchangeable for recipes during this time and can deal with medical recipes, cookery recipes, or household recipes for cleaning your clothing. These receipt books form part of a literary genre that is unique to early modern England, informed by a mass of printed culinary literature that includes cookbooks, etiquette manuals, household manuals, books of secrets, and dietary books. These receipt books also connect directly to personal writings such as diaries, journals, letters, and commonplace books. They can be used to provide insight into many facets of early modern writing and book creation at a time when literacy and print are combining to revolutionize the way in which information is disseminated and consumed. This early modern British cook relied on many of the same ingredients, tools, and preparations in the kitchen as we do today. And although they may not have had the luxury of consulting Google for their meal ideas, they did have access to a large and even international pool of recipes, which were shared through vast and complex ways. It was a recipe for chocolate that initially led me along the path to revealing this interesting network around choice receipts. I took an interest as a modern chocolate lover, of course, and also because of the claim in the title that it was given to the compiler by a close relative. The title reads, Chocolate, My Aunt Masham's Way, which is a personal inviting for the modern reader, allowing you to feel as if you just stumbled upon this fragile exchange between family members. You can then imagine my surprise when I stumbled across the same recipe, nearly verbatim, in another receipt book penned and signed by another woman named Johanna St. John. You can click that one more time. Finding the receipt in two different books brings about a sudden sobering experience, dampening the romantic notion and replacing it with a skepticism that highlights one of the central problems surrounding the attribution of the sources for recipes. What degree of separation exists between the original recipe and its record in a given book? Throughout the course of my research, I would continue to find evidence that the compiler of the book recorded recipes directly from a variety of other sources. Of the 390 recipes, 83 distinct sources are named, 25 of which are repeated. In total, 129 out of the 390 receipts are attributed to a named source, accounting for a whole one-third of recipes. The first and most obvious line of questioning is, who are these sources? Were they real people, or were they merely names attached to recipes for cachet? Did the compiler of the manuscript have direct contact with these sources? And finally, how does one understand and trace the recipes that don't have a source? Are these the actual recipes of the compiler or author of the book? It's my hypothesis that among these credited as sources are both historical and fictitious characters. Evidence suggests the compiler did have contact with some of the named sources, such as Johannes St. John. In other cases, it's more likely that the receipts were acquired through a third party who may or may not have had direct contact with the original source. As I would later come to realize, the recipe for chocolate was not the only instance of overlap between the two books. In fact, there are enough cases of distinct overlap between Johanna's book and Choice Receipts to conclude that one was copied almost exclusively from the other. Discerning the direction of copying can be especially tricky, and yet a close inspection of the book and surrounding recipes can reveal clues that aid in this process. For example, there's evidence that Johanna's book was compiled through multiple generations based on various handwritings throughout the book. So you'll see one hand and then another hand right after that following with a different recipe. So someone is going through them alphabetically and putting recipes in where they belong. So it's not so much chronological as it is typographical and alphabetical. Choice Receipts, however, was penned exclusively by one hand. This leads to the conclusion that Johanna's book must be the source for the recipes because her book would have had to have been finished before it could be completely copied by another source, such as the writer of Choice Receipts. Other examples are perhaps more concrete. Choice Receipts also includes a recipe to make bean bread, which is attributed to the Lady Lowther. As it so happens, the Wellcome Library Collection contains a manuscript cookbook from the Lowther family, in which the same recipe for bean bread may be found. Copied nearly verbatim, it is quite clear that the compiler of Choice Receipts took the receipt from the Lowther cookbook. As you can see from the images, the original recipe in the Lowther book is simply titled To Make a Bean Bread, while the author of Choice Receipts extends the title to include the source information. So with Johanna, you kind of have to do a little digging to figure out which direction this was. In the Lowther example, it's definitely a lot more clear. Despite a lack of provenance information regarding Choice Receipts, an investigation into the sources has helped shed light on this otherwise anonymous manuscript, by placing it at the center of a complex web of recipe sharing that includes both printed and manuscript sources spanning the course of the 17th and the 18th centuries. Can click one more. When these exchanges can be documented, they can be used to trace the lifespan of books, which can lead to the restoration of the book's provenance and creation history. Resources limit the possibility of matching every receipt to its source, but even uncovering a few isolated incidents can be a very rewarding endeavor. Perhaps the anonymous book can begin a more concrete provenance if additional discoveries of connections with other books and manuscripts can be made in the future, which is something that I'm as an ongoing project I've been working on. Until then, the book and its contents are as diverse as they are choice. Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from Elizabeth Field. She is a Canon, New York-based food writer who worked for 11 years at the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. She has contributed to the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Gourmet, Saveur, Gastronomica, and Edible Roadie. And while living in Dublin, Ireland for seven years, wrote for the Irish Times and Bridgestone Guides. Marmalade, her first book, stems from her master's dissertation in gastronomy from the University of Adelaide, Australia, and reflects a lifelong passion for marmalade. And in case you weren't aware, there are copies of the book for sale, and it is a lovely book. I've just been able to look at it briefly tonight, and it looks like it is well worth the read. So, Elizabeth? Do you want to be clipped or hold?
I don't know.
We'll clip you.
Clip me. Oh, okay. Don't walk. And Ari, do I just tell you?
Okay. Go for it.
Fantastic. Okay. Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. I'm going to speak very briefly about a subject that I could speak very lengthily about. and that is marmalade. I'm going to try in a very short time to give you a sense of marmalade's 2,500-year-old history, how marmalade evolved through time, and where it is today. The earliest forms of marmalade were made from quince, as we see. The ancient Greeks and Romans boiled quinces and honey together to form a solid paste, which was used as a remedy for everything from an upset stomach to brain disorders. Under the Galenic medical system, foods were assigned particular characteristics, and patients were advised to eat these foods to correct any physical or mental imbalances. Quince paste moved westward from Greece and Rome and arrived in Spain around the 8th century. The word marmalada derives from marmelo, the Portuguese word for quince. Okay. This is a still life by Quadros de Luis Melendez, who lived in the 18th century. And even though we're jumping ahead here in time, you'll see in the still life round boxes which contained solid quince paste. This was the method in which the quince paste was stored and transported. And it was kept in these boxes for quite a long time. Moving backwards a little bit, back to Spain and Portugal, they had a long time trading relationship with England, and the first shipments of marmalade arrived in London around 1495. Okay. This year shows both red and white quince marmalade molded into fancy shapes. The marmalade becomes darker if you cook it longer. A Northern European marmalade developed at the same time that the Southern marmalades were being shipped up to England. And these Northern marmalades were often, they contained quinces and sugar. They were being flavored with sugar now as opposed to honey. And they were flavored with cloves, cinnamon, spices that mimicked the hypocras, or spiced wine, that was served after banquets. This Northern European version of marmalade was called alternately chardequince, cotignac, or cidoni. When the marmalade was molded into fancy shapes like this, it was served as part of a very extensive banqueting table of sweetmeats that were served after medieval dinners. In the 16th and 17th century, marmalade is not only considered medicinal, but it's considered an aphrodisiac as well. And that's probably because it was so expensive. Okay, next. This is an image of a still room where country gentlewomen supervised the making of marmalade, confectionery, and medicines for the household. The mistress of the house supervised these operations because of the use of sugar. Sugar was so expensive that they didn't want any, you know, wayward hands to make off with the sugar. Okay, next. Okay, the next main development in the evolution of marmalade was the introduction of Seville oranges, which you see here. These are bitter oranges as compared to sweet oranges, which we eat all the time. They grow in southern climates, Spain, Portugal. There's very small production in this country. But these oranges had been imported into England and Scotland for some years. And at some point towards the end of the 18th century, no one really knows why, but people started to make marmalades out of oranges. There's an apocryphal story, which is very apocryphal, that a ship ran aground outside Dundee Harbor carrying a shipload of Seville oranges, and the legend goes that the grocer's wife, Janet Keeler, took these oranges, made them into marmalade, and thus was the beginning of the Keeler Marmalade Company, which is very long-lived, but as I said, that's apocryphal. Okay, next. The other two interesting developments, in addition to oranges being used, is that the texture had changed. Marmalade was no longer a solid paste. It was much more semi-liquid. And I see the samples are going around. One of the samples, I don't know if it went around yet, this one looks like it's the Seville orange marmalade. So you'll get that distinctive, sharp, sweet taste that's really, you know, the character of traditional marmalade. Okay, next. Okay, this is just a crock from the Keeler Marmalade Company, which was established in Dundee, Scotland in 1798. Part of the reason that marmalade became more popular was the fact that England dominated the sugar trade in the West Indies. So there was a greater availability of sugar coming into England, and thus prices dropped. Okay. The sugar industry was driven by slavery. There are many stories of the hardships that slaves underwent. The process of producing sugar is very hot and very dangerous, but it was slaves who produced the sugar. Moving back into the sugar supply in England, as sugar became more plentiful and cheaper, commercial marmalade companies did arise all over the country. And in fact, one of the early editions of Mrs. Beaton tells cooks to use commercial marmalade instead of homemade marmalade because it's cheaper and of equal quality. Okay, next. Here we have a map of the British Empire in 1920. As you can see, it takes up almost 25% of the globe. And as the colonists traveled outward from England, they brought their marmalade with them. They brought either recipes for marmalade, or they brought the imported, they exported the commercial marmalades. So marmalades ended up traveling really all over the world. Okay, next. Here's an example of a kind of colonial mentality that is reflected here in an advertising mascot for Robertson's Marmalade, made in this advertisement, was first produced in 1910. And this little creature here was called a gollywog, and he became a collectible item and, you know, considered a very iconic little creature in, you know, in England and Scotland. This gollywog advertising continued up to 1987, that went that long, until it was taken away because of its offensive nature. And I have to say, at one marmalade festival I attended in Wales, they were still selling stuffed gollywog dolls, which were going like hotcakes. Okay, the next is we have some examples of Asian citrus of various types. So as I said, as marmalade traveled to different locales, the people there used whatever local fruit was available to make marmalade. In America, orange marmalade never really caught on that well. Oranges were expensive, and the settlers came to use more available tree fruits and ground fruits. Finally, my last image here is just an image of kind of a modern use of marmalade, an American use. Rather than slathering it on our toast with butter, we're more likely to combine it in desserts or with yogurt. The other thing, too, that's coming back into style, it never really went away, was Membrio, which is the solid quince marmalade, and you see that very often on cheese plates now. So in eating Membrio, you've gone full circle from the beginning of marmalade's history to the present time and back. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Elizabeth, our next speaker is Kara Newman, who is the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food, From Commodities Markets to Supermarkets, to be published by Columbia University Press in November of 2012. Think about Christmas presents, people. She previously toiled in the financial services industries, but is now a food and beverage writer working with Wine Enthusiast magazine and other publications. She does know a little bit about cocktails as well, I think it's fair to say. You may have seen that book with the pink cover about cocktails. Anyway, Kara? Hold or clip?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. So, here we go. Okay. So, I am particularly excited to talk about this book with this group, because quite frankly, we've all had a lot to do with this book getting started. I started with the Culinary Historians of New York 10 years ago. I'm celebrating my 10-year anniversary. I feel like I should get an award for that. Thank you. And when I started, I worked in the financial services industry. And at the time, I was given an assignment to first cover the equities market, then cover the fixed income market, and then cover the commodities market. And for those of you who don't really know a lot about the market, I'll be really brief. It's essentially a marketplace in which traders buy and sell contracts that represent promises to deliver underlying products. And sometimes those products are things like gold and silver and oil, and other times they're food. They are soybeans and pork bellies and in earlier times, they were things like chickens and peppercorns and eggs and butter, which I'm going to try to talk about tonight. And when I started working on this, it really seemed to me like a menu more than anything else. And about 4 years ago, the Culinary Historians was kind enough to let me talk a little bit about my independent research on pork bellies. And I know a lot of you were there. And that became the sample chapter for my book. Next slide, please. And there it is, my baby. So thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about butter and eggs. That's a small chapter within the book. If you want to go to the next slide, please. I have a couple of illustrations here to show you what the markets used to look like. It's hard to see. It's probably a little bit grainy. But in the upper right side of the chalkboard, you can see that it says cheese and eggs. And that's the New York Butter, the New York Butter, Egg, and Cheese Exchange circa 1880. And that later became the New York Produce Exchange. And the next slide shows egg traders at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. They're handling the merchandise there. That's a press shot from 1949 for the introduction of frozen egg contracts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in a moment. So the next slide, I just want to talk real quickly about the different kinds of eggs that traded, because there really were quite a few, as I found in my research, and it seems like a nice little neat list now, but it really took a lot of pulling together all the different types of eggs. So fresh eggs were the gold standard, but obviously it's challenging to find a way to preserve them for use during the winter, and they trade, of course, according to supply and demand. And the benefit to creating limed and pickled eggs, the first kind of eggs up there. According to one account, some were packed in salt, some in lime, others in tanks containing various pickling solutions. And obviously advantage, they preserved well through the winter months, but disadvantage, they tasted very strongly of the preservative. And so they were priced substantially less than the fresh eggs. Next up, we have storage eggs and butter, and those traded separately from fresh eggs. And what they were is, according to the old school Chicago eggmen, the dealers would buy the fresh eggs, they would coat the eggshells with a light layer of vegetable oil, and then they would store them in a cooler or storage room, and then they would hold on to them until prices rose in the colder months. And then they would sell the eggs, those lovely cold stored eggs for months, to hotels, restaurants, and others. And then you had the frozen eggs, and those might keep for years. And those started life as storage eggs, and they were sold to egg-breaking companies. And in the egg-breaking plant, the workers would flash handle the eggs. They would hold the egg up to the light, and they'd examine it for internal defects. And if they passed the test, they were broken and dumped into stainless steel vats. And they were sold to bakeries, pie, noodle, and mayonnaise makers. And they were especially popular with the military. Next slide, please. And that says, poor old public must eat fresh butter and eggs. This is from World War I, which caused a shortage of storage eggs for the general public. Okay, next slide, please. So I also wanted to talk briefly about the butter and egg man as part of popular American culture. So the butter and egger. He usually operated a warehouse or a storefront in the city, such as around the Tribeca area. In 1925, next slide, please. Sorry, where are we now? There we go. We have, in 1925, George Kaufman's play Butter and Eggman debuted on Broadway. And it was about a Midwestern sucker who was so free with his money that some Eastern city slickers take him for a ride. And Butter and Eggman became a disparaging term. You know, he was a dupe with a taste for bottle blondes, and it did and it did well. It played on stages across the country. Obviously, not everyone was happy about it. Next slide, please. It became a 1928 silent film. Didn't do so well, but it's notable because a very young Ginger Rogers is in the movie. Next slide. It became a motion picture, Technicolor. Next slide, we have a jazz song recorded by Louis Armstrong, the big butter and egg man. And then finally, the last portion, I'd like to talk about the dairy traders here in Tribeca, quite close to where we are now. This is 1927, Zimmer and Duncak butter and egg, New York merchants. The next slide shows Duane Park circa 1944, and you can see the sign for butter and eggs in the upper left-hand corner. And here, the middlemen would bring in barrelfuls of eggs from the local farms, cushioned by oats, and they would sell them to the New York City stores and restaurants. And the next slide shows you, again, same scene, moving over a little bit to one side. This is 1998. This is Harry Wills and Co. And they were the last ones to leave the dairy industry. They were, you know, the last ones out, you know, shut the lights. And that was their company. And before they left, next slide, please. That's a snapshot from Duane Park. Reserved for the ghosts of commerce. Harry Wills and Company left their legacy. And it's still there. It's no longer anything to do with the dairy industry, unfortunately. But, you know, it's a nice legacy there. And next slide, last slide. I'd just like to conclude with a poem that ran in the Chicago Daily News when Chicago's new mercantile exchange came into being. Hail, noble shell of busy trade, in butter, also eggs fresh laid, or else in pristine freshness stored in some chill super-Arctic hoard. Hail, produce temple, multi-tiered, your white and sunny side upreared, Well, Bill, to bear your workday's yoke, you've capitalized a nation's joke. And though consumers feast or fast, your butter and egg men laugh the last. Thank you.